All right, our next case this morning is case number 11-1816 and 11-1817, Howland versus First American. Mr. Eaton. Sorry, I didn't even let you sit down.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tim Eaton on behalf of the appellants. Your Honor, federal law and state law have made it clear that title companies cannot encourage attorney title agents to steer business towards them by giving them either kickbacks, unearned fees, or referral fees. And that's exactly what we have in this case. And respectfully, the district court, and particularly the defendants, were arguing the wrong legal standard to determine whether or not this was a legitimate class. There were two common questions which, if answered in the affirmative, would establish that there is a class here that has been injured and no individualized questions would need to be asked at all. The district court determined that there were too many individualized questions that would predominate under Rule 23b3. We respectfully disagree, because if, in fact, what the title company gave to these attorney title agents is a pro forma commitment, and if they were paid the full rate that was entered into in their agreements with the title company, their full fee, then if those questions are answered in the affirmative, it's clear under the enforcement statement policies of HUD that there's a violation of RESPA. It's also clear that that's a violation of state law, and we should be able to proceed. The difficulty is that this case was treated by the defendants as if it were a summary judgment, that we would have to prevail on those questions in order to go forward with our class. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has said in the Walmart versus Dukes case that you can look at the merits, but it's a brief look to determine two things. One, are there common questions that apply to the class? And more importantly, if those questions are answered, will it resolve the dispute? In Dukes, they determined it would not. In this case, an answer to those common questions in the affirmative would resolve it because of HUD enforcement's own statement policies. This case has also been up before this court in a similar situation in the Schleicher case, which we cite in our brief, where a panel of this court said that the burden in a class case when looking on the merits is not to determine whether or not the class will prevail. If the questions are answered in the negative and they lose, that doesn't mean it was not a legitimate class certification. So our argument is that if we're able to pose two common questions, if those questions are answered in the affirmative, then we can go forward and try to prove our case.
Counsel, let me ask.
Yes.
If the search summary sheet was returned without changes,
yes,
why is that dispositive of the attorney agents not being able to receive full compensation based on services of value that were provided consistent with 8C2? And if that's true, then wouldn't that require an individual analysis of the attorney agent's work?
Your Honor, to begin with, let me state, first of all, with respect to if there were no changes, is that dispositive? And we're not alleging that it is. What we are saying is that if the search summary sheet is a pro forma commitment, one indicia of that is if it's returned unsigned, excuse me, if it's returned not changed, and the title company is able to go forward then and just submit the boilerplate clauses in it and issue the title policy, that is a strong indication of a performance commitment. Under 8C1, there's an exception that attorneys can be paid fees if they're providing core title services. HUD has issued a policy statement which has said that if there's a pro forma commitment, then the attorney agent is not providing core title services, that at best their work is a reexamination, redundant, or no work at all. There's another exception, Your Honor, under 8C2, which says if they provide other services other than core title services, they may be paid. But there's also a HUD enforcement policy statement which says that if that's the provision that applies and if they have not provided core title services, then there must be a reduction, a commensurate reduction in the amount they're charging. Here, by definition, the class is only those attorney agents that have received their full rate under the attorney agreements that they entered into with the title company.
And you're saying yes. There's no way to achieve a full rate of compensation without doing the pro forma services, or the core title services.
That's correct. Because under both the attorney agent contract, Your Honor, they provide that they must, in fact, we believe that that contract is limited only to providing core title services. But even if it was not, even if, as defendant argues, they could provide other services, HUD has made it clear that if they are providing other services other than core title services, it must be at a reduced amount, which is why we added to the class definition where an attorney is receiving their full contract rate. And by the way, the full contract rate that we're talking about under the attorney agreement is a percentage. It's a percentage of the premium, and it can be as high as 70-80%. That's why in the Chilton case in the Illinois Appellate Court, which is the only case we're aware of where this has been dealt with, the court found that it was an abuse of discretion not to certify a class in that case. And defendant says, well, under those circumstances, the court was only looking at the allegations to determine whether they stated a proper class, and under federal law, you have to look at the merits to determine whether or not it could go forward. And in fact, the appellate court did more than that. It did actually look at the defenses that were raised by the defendant in that case, and it determined that with the HUD enforcement statements, which could be given some weight, there was enough to go forward on the merits to determine those two questions. And, Your Honors, by the way, we also had expert reports which were submitted in this case. We had the experts testify, someone who had been with HUD before, someone who had been with title companies in Illinois, and they both testified that what we are dealing here with a cert summary sheet is a pro forma commitment. Because when you get this cert summary sheet back, all the attorney has to do is sign it and send it in, and that's how we've defined our class. If they've done any more work than that, they do not fit within the definition of our class. If they are paid less than the full rate, they do not fit within the definition of our class. That's why, with all due respect, we believe the district court was incorrect in determining, as a matter of law, that these were not pro forma commitments, because that's the conclusion he reached in deciding that there were not adequate common questions that would resolve the dispute.
It seems to me that the facts of Ms. Howland's transaction itself demonstrates why these inquiries are individualized, because one of these summary sheets was used, right? And yet there were core title services that were performed by the attorney, or if not that, then additional title services to the extent that questions were raised about homestead rights and so forth after the summary sheet was provided.
Your Honor, HUD has taken enforcement positions which we think are critical in this case, which has said that if you're given a pro forma commitment, any other work that you do is duplicative or reexamination and therefore does not count towards core title services.
That's an argument against construing the summary sheet that's used by this company as a pro forma commitment, because it doesn't operate that way.
Well, this...
It's title evidence. It's not statement of position about insurability, et cetera.
Well, Your Honor, it's much more than title evidence. And by the way, this goes to the merits of what would be our burden to prove. And we can prove it because this is more than title evidence. It covers more than just showing what mortgages might be open, what liens may be open. Then they do a search of those, and they determine where they've been released, and they examine the information. Then they put together the search title sheet, search summary sheet, which obviously answers all the questions that they need to know. This is more than just a title search or title evidence. Every question they need to know has been answered, and then they turn around and they issue a title policy. So this is not a fact-based inquiry.
Later in the process, after the attorney has done his or her work, I mean, the summary sheet just does not function as a pro forma title insurance commitment.
Well, Your Honor, what we're getting into is a discussion about the merits of whether we can show that there was a pro forma commitment.
But the problem here is that one of the critical premises of your class definition and your certification, class certification motion, is this factual issue that just doesn't obtain here and did not obtain in Ms. Howland's case.
Oh, Your Honor, I do disagree. I think it did obtain in Ms. Howland's case, because what we will show on the evidence is that what was the search summary sheet that was given to the attorney, in this case to represent the seller, was a pro forma commitment under the law and under HUD enforcement policy statements. And given that fact, they cannot charge for court title services under HUD's interpretation of the statute. And then if they try to charge for any other services, it must be at a reduced rate, which is why when we demonstrate that these attorneys receive the full amount that they were due under the attorney-agent contract, that it was obviously unearned fees and is in violation of RESPA. Because the question becomes, Your Honor, why else would the title company be providing everything that the attorney needed, where all they had to do was sign, send it back, and they would issue a policy? Why would they pay the full rate for that? Well, I think the answer is simple. It's because under those circumstances, the attorney had steered the business to them, and it was a kickback. It was unearned fees for simply doing something that wasn't required. And under the statute, that is a violation. Under the HUD interpretation, that is a violation. And those were the exact same questions that the Chelton case was about in the First District of the Appellate Court when they reviewed those very same questions. The fact that an attorney may have done some work is irrelevant. If it's a pro forma commitment, they cannot charge for court title services under HUD's interpretation. Then you look at the second exception to see whether it applies.
Even if your scenario is true, isn't the attorney providing value by virtue of the fact that they're interpreting the information that's provided to them and they're validating it, and then ultimately they're accepting liability for their signing off on the search summary sheet? So aren't they providing a service of value for which they should be fully compensated?
Well, Your Honor, when you look at the interpretation that's given by HUD, first of all, you're dealing here with attorney title agents that are representing either the seller or the buyer. So they have a responsibility at that closing for their client, not necessarily as a title agent for that company. The company is taking care of itself by doing all of the work that they needed to do for themselves, for the defendant. Then they submit the search summary sheet where all the attorney has to do is sign off. If the attorney is doing other tasks, either they're not relevant to the court title services, as is indicated from the search summary sheet, because, by the way, if you look at the ultimate title policy, Schedules A and B are identical to what's in the search summary sheet. And under the definition by HUD, that indicates that the core title services have been performed. No other work needs to be done. And we do not need to get into a situation to determine in each transaction what the attorney performed, because HUD has filled in that gap for us. HUD has said, if there's a pro forma commitment and you can prove it, which is what we intend to do, then they cannot charge for court title services. And if they're performing services other than court title services, they cannot be given the full rate under the contract, which is what they agreed to do, which is provide insurability of title.
I'm a little unclear about what the harm is.
The harm in this case, Your Honor, we have a service commitment fee of $1,010, which is charged in this particular case. Approximately
That gets charged to the seller?
Yes, the consumer.
Ms. Howland is the buyer.
That's correct. I think her amount was $260. That gets charged by the title company, and then they turn around and they pay the attorney $850 of that, like 70 to 80% of the full amount.
Right, but the parties to the mortgage transaction, the buyer and the seller, are not getting a title insurance policy that's worth less, right? They're getting what they paid for.
The reason they don't want these kickbacks, Your Honor, is that it's obvious a title company can do it for 30% of what they charge to the consumers. So if they're not paying the attorneys the kickback for work that's not being performed, then the consumer ultimately is going to be paying less. They may be paying 30% of the fee that they paid. So that's the harm to either the seller or the buyer, is that these amounts would be substantially less, which is why we have the statute, why RESPA was enacted to safeguard either the purchaser or the seller from having to pay higher fees when those fees are being paid to have the title insurance brought to them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. The District Court did not abuse its discretion in rejecting plaintiffs' multiple efforts to certify a class in this RESPA kickback case. We've put in our brief really an unbroken line of cases that say class certification doesn't work in a RESPA kickback case precisely because RESPA requires transaction-specific individual inquiries on two levels. First, if there are core title services, then the payment is per se legal, full stop. That's C1B. Second, even if there are no core title services, an attorney agent can still be paid a reasonable amount for services actually performed. So two inquiries: what services were performed, and was the amount paid reasonable? That's why, in the mine run of RESPA kickback cases, class certification is deemed not appropriate. What plaintiffs did here was to say we can get around those cases through a shortcut, well, in fact, a series of shortcuts. And when that happens, the court had not only the right but the obligation to assess for itself whether those shortcuts would work. Plaintiffs referenced the Schleicher case, fraud on the market. That actually comes up in the footnote in Dukes, which we've cited, where the court says, yes, fraud on the market is a merits inquiry, but since it is so relevant to a class certification question in a securities case, it has to be adjudicated at the class certification phase, even though it will come up again on the merits. Where plaintiffs have taken on the burden of proving a shortcut to get out of the normal analytics of RESPA, it's their burden to show it would work. And for each of the shortcuts they proposed, Judge Guzman went through and analyzed and said, this doesn't work for this reason, this doesn't work for that reason, and we've laid those out in our briefs. Certainly, there was no abuse of discretion in his determination that this case was not certifiable as a class.
You indicate that under HC2, the attorney agent can be paid a reasonable amount. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can a reasonable amount ever equal full compensation?
Yes, Your Honor, and I want to be clear on that. I think I heard plaintiff's counsel say full rate under the contract, and that's just not what the guidance, that is not, that can't be paid if there's no core title services, and that's just not what the guidance says. The guidance talks in terms of a reduced amount being appropriate, certainly, but you can't look at that from the perspective of whether it was a schedule rate paid or not, and here's how we know that. The Culpepper case out of the 11th Circuit involving mortgage brokers was a C2 case, and the mortgage brokers were paid, as our people are paid, from a schedule. Based on value. And the 11th Circuit had actually certified a class because the allegation was just paying them the full rate based on that schedule programmatically violates RESPA. And in 2001, HUD came out with a policy statement and said, no, you can't look at the program. You have to look at the individual transaction. The fact that the same rate is paid as a schedule rate, the fact that that company might not even know what an agent did in a given case, does not matter to us. What we want to look at is whether that rate, when paid from the schedule, was appropriate in the factual circumstances of that transaction. And in light of that, in a later case, Culpepper, the 11th Circuit went back and said, no, we were wrong the first time around. You can't challenge the program just because a schedule rate is paid. You must look at the services performed and see whether that rate, in an individual case, was an appropriate rate. So the C2 shortcut also doesn't work.
Effort in your brief to distinguish this Illinois Appellate Court case, Chilton?
Yes, Your Honor.
Seems to be focused on different pleading standards. Is that the distinction you want to make between your situation and that case?
We believe the distinction between this case and Chilton is, in Chilton, the appellate court in the First District said, and this was central to its holding, taking allegations as true, if plaintiffs are able to prove their allegations at trial, then they will prevail and establish a common way of doing this, making class certification appropriate. We believe under Dukes, and especially the footnote that talks about Halliburton, that's not how federal courts applying Rule 23, which is a different question, approach things. Federal courts in applying Rule 23 have to figure out, when shortcuts are proposed, whether they will work. And if they won't, then it's not a good use of the court's time and resources to go through adjudicating questions that don't solve liability for anyone.
Well, do you disagree with the Illinois Appellate Court's treatment of RESPA in the Chultum case?
So in the Chultum case, the Illinois Appellate Court talked about whether it could be a pro forma commitment, and it talked about RESPA guidance, but then ultimately said, we don't have to decide this today. We can be agnostic. We'll certify the class because if that question is answered in the affirmative, that it's a pro forma commitment and that precludes payment, that's enough. Judge Guzman went one step further and said, first of all, I have to decide whether it is a pro forma commitment. But then he backed off and said, no, didn't decide it, and said, even if it were a pro forma commitment, give them all their due, still you've got C2 that says, and this was the first class certification decision, C2 says they can be paid for services performed. Now, even the appellants have said in their brief, reply, page 13, that there is overlap between core title services and C2 services. Just because it's core title doesn't mean it's not also compensable under C2. And whatever happened, we certainly know that on the facts of Howland's transaction, the agent was doing work. In fact, two of the biggest pieces of the transaction, a $5,000 option to buy that didn't show up on the search summary sheet, and a homestead right in the seller's wife that did not show up on the search summary sheet, were independently discovered and resolved by the agent and didn't have to show up on the search summary sheet or the ultimate title commitment because he took the initiative to do that work. That is work for which compensation is appropriate under C2. And that just shows, as we knew from the beginning, RESPA is an individual inquiry.
So you're saying the search summary sheet is not necessarily indicative of the work that's performed by the attorney agent?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. And we think in Ms. Howland's transaction especially, the facts show that there's an awful lot of work being done that will never arrive on a search summary sheet. The bottom line, Your Honors, is we don't believe that in walking through each of the proposed shortcuts and finding that they didn't work, that Judge Guzman abused his discretion. In fact, we think he got it exactly right. Let me briefly mention one secondary point, which is even if all of the foregoing were of no avail to us, and we think we're right, there's a statute of limitations problem in this case. The case wasn't filed until 2007. The class, as written, cuts off at 2005. RESPA has a one-year statute of limitations. So everyone, by definition, who is a member of the class is going to have a statute of limitations problem that they're going to have to overcome. While certainly individual defenses might not preclude class certification, where everyone has a statute of limitations problem to overcome, that's a problem. How do we know that? Because in their briefing, the plaintiff said, that's okay. We can answer that with a discovery rule, which would apply across the board to everyone. I mean, I don't know if that's true. We don't believe it is. But even if it were, discovery rule just means what did each individual plaintiff know and when did they know it, especially because under First American policies and procedures, each individual agent was required to disclose to parties to a transaction what the payment was and where it was going and that they had an interest. And indeed, both Steck and Howland, buyer and seller in this transaction, signed a form just like that the day before their transaction closed. So even if the merits question didn't have its own analytical individual issues, the statute of limitations question would overwash everything with those issues.
Now, Ms. Howland has settled her claim.
She has, Your Honor.
And is out of the case?
She has settled out her claim. She accepted an offer of judgment for $75,000. She has appealed the class certification determination, and Scott Tettmeyer has also intervened also to appeal the class certification determination.
Well, does she continue to be an appropriate class representative under the circumstances, or should we just be focusing on the intervening plaintiff? She's done. She settled her case. She got a final judgment. You know, this issue of reserving the right to challenge the class certification decision runs against the grain of our rule in this circuit. Now, that may not make any difference here in terms of having a live claim on appeal because of the presence of the intervening plaintiff, but it seems to me that she's out. Is that not correct?
That could well be, Your Honor. As Your Honor points out, the decisions haven't walked an entirely straight line, but in either event, Mr. Tettmeyer is here appealing the class cert determination.
Do we have some information about his transaction?
you know, very minimal with just what's in the complaint. No discovery was done on Mr. Tettmeyer. But we don't think the case turns on that. We think that whether it was appropriate to certify a class, whoever you pick as the class representative, put it this way, if Tettmeyer is fundamentally different, then that's another argument why we ought not be adjudicating everyone's claims through one representative.
Counsel, I wanted to ask you, I think it's a fair statement that there's been a large increase in lawsuits over recent history involving title policies. My question to you would be, in those lawsuits, is the attorney agent typically joined as a party in those cases? And if not, is that indicative of the extent to whether or not there's an arm's length transaction going on between the title company and the attorney agent?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. What I do know is that the price that people pay, to respond to one comment we heard about the agency relationship, First American also sells title insurance policies just as First American without an attorney agent. And the price that consumers pay, and this is in the record, is the same whether you use an attorney agent or whether you call up First American and yourself and say, I'd like a title policy. The price doesn't change at all. It's the same price from that schedule sheet.
So the use of attorney agents is not inflating the price?
No, Your Honor.
Or it is, but the company is keeping the profit.
It doesn't independently make a difference.
Right. I got it.
There are no further questions. We would respectfully ask that Judge Guzman's decisions be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Eaton, your time has expired, but I'll give you 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, if I could answer just a few of the questions that were asked. With respect to your last question, I think in the Premium Plus decision versus Goldman Sachs in August 2011, this court, and I believe you and Judge Tinder were actually on the panel, had said that where there was a Rule 68 settlement offer, that that class representative may not have any skin in the game and can continue. And in fact, in that opinion, they invited perhaps the use of an intervener, keep the case warm, I think was the language used in the opinion. And that's exactly what we have here. Tegmeyer can go forward, so I don't see that as an issue. The other thing with respect to the Cheltenham case, Your Honor, Judge Tinder, you ask about, is that the only distinction is based on the pleadings? If, when you read that opinion carefully, the court actually did test, kick the tires of those questions to determine, one, whether or not it could be proved, and they cited the HUD opinions, and two, whether or not it would resolve the case. So they were using exactly the federal-type standard in that case and weren't relying solely on the pleadings. And let me make one other comment.
The Illinois standard is different, though, isn't it?
It is. Conceivably, it is different because they only look at what if
you... Might surprise you that we actually read some of these cases.
Pardon me? Yes, yes. But they went further and did a merits-based review and reached the conclusion we're asking this court to reach. And finally, under RESPA, there are two different things you look at. One, you have situations where if there's no fee involved, it's improper to pay. Two, if it's reasonable fees, then that gets into an individualized standard. And here we believe because no fee was warranted based upon a reexamination or no services rendered, that's the prong we're operating under, and that is not an individualized standard. That is a common standard, and we believe that all the cases that have been cited by the defendant have dealt with the prong dealing with reasonable fees being paid to brokers. Here we're talking about a no fee, and the 11th Circuit in the Busby case, which we have cited, has said that we are dealing with whether there should be no fee charged, you can have a class, and in fact they certified a class under RESPA under those circumstances. And we would respectfully ask that this court reverse the decision of the district court and allow this class to be certified. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.